Thank you, Sharon. And thank you, Liz, for living up to your billing as an amazing actress and reading so well. That was very good. Just before I begin, in the spirit of reminding you to be praying for those you might invite to Alpha, there are a few copies of this book at the back, which, if you think there is someone that you might give this to who would really benefit from reading it, you're happy to take. Don't just take it as a freebie. As in, do take it as a freebie, but only take it if you're going to give it to someone. The book is called Is Christmas Unbelievable? And there are four questions it addresses, really easy read. Was Jesus even a real person? Can we take the Bible seriously? How can you believe in a virgin birth? Why does it even matter? If you've got someone who's, you know, really kind of argumentative maybe, and just think, I want someone else to answer those questions better than I can, this is a really good book. Feel free to take one and give it to that person if you'd like to. They're at the back. Okay, so we're in Jeremiah 2. Last week, I was in Bath, and I went to a jeweller's in Bath. Now, before my wife gets excited that she's going to be given diamonds for Christmas, and I'm going to spend my hard-earned stipend on diamonds, I couldn't afford any. I went into the shop to check this very illustration. It was kind of peak vicaring for me. And the illustration is that when jewellers want to show off the brilliance of a diamond or a pearl, they very often set it in a kind of dark, velvety box. So I went in and I spoke to the lady. I said, this is a bit of a weird one. I'm a vicar. And she kind of looked confused. But hey presto, under the cabinet, there were just rows of, and it was exactly what I was hoping I would see for this illustration, there were rows of dark, velvety boxes, a little bit like this one. If you can see, there's a kind of a dark background, and in it is one of my wife's beautiful earrings. Don't think they're real diamonds. But anyway, there we go. And the reason they do that is that the dark velvety box obviously contrasts with the diamond or the pearl and shows it in all its brilliance. Now, we are in our Advent series looking at the whole Christmas story, seeing how the birth of this baby 2,000 years ago fits into the great narrative of the Bible and indeed the narrative of the universe. And I want us to think about it like this. If the birth of Jesus is a diamond, today we are setting it in its dark velvet box, in its black box. Not because we like the darkness, but because only when we grasp the extent of the darkness will we see the brilliance of the diamond. Or to put it another way, only when we grasp the seriousness of our situation before God will we see the absolute joy of the baby born in a manger who was to be called Jesus, God saves. Why? Because he will save his people from their sins. So maybe this morning, as we gather, you might be feeling cynical about Christmas, the same old carols, the same traditions, the same old story of the nativity, the same family gatherings, the same dubious jumpers pulled out year after year. If that is you, I hope this morning that your sense of wonder at this baby born in a manger in the town of David is renewed. And perhaps if there are some online here or in person perhaps who don't really see why this story of the baby in a manger still hits all the headlines thousands of years later, what is the point of it? What is its relevance? Well, I hope today you see that there are no bigger fish to fry. This is the heart of life itself. And if that is what you're thinking, if you're wondering what the reason is, well, this is maybe sounds a bit creepy, and at the risk of sounding a bit weird and creepy, let me take you into the dark so that you can see the diamond of Christmas. Our guide to the darkness today is a prophet who was writing 600 years before Jesus, Prophet Jeremiah, over 2,500 years before our day. And yet I think what he does is diagnose the human condition with terrifying accuracy and I think quite frightening relevance as well to us, even in our day. So Jeremiah chapter 2, I think page 757 in Pew Bibles, maybe. Try that, but otherwise find Jeremiah 2. And here in this chapter, Jeremiah is addressing the people of God, as I say, 600 years before Christ, there or thereabouts. They couldn't therefore be further from our time or our kind of living experience. And yet, as I say, the description of their spiritual state is kind of bang on for us today. The main thrust of chapter 2, if you read the whole thing in your own time, actually compares the Israelites to an unfaithful, adulterous wife. It's not a very favorable comparison. The people of God were meant to be his treasured bride, his possession, his partner in the world, his beloved, and they had been unfaithful, desperately unfaithful. If you read the chapter, it's drenched in the pain that many of us may know first or second hand, that of anger or disappointment, betrayal, grief. It is a relationship broken. That's what we read in chapter 2. But just in the section that Liz read for us, there are two particular ways in which God, through Jeremiah, describes their unfaithfulness. Two sins. He says in verse 12, and this is strong language. He says, "Be appalled, you heavens, and shudder with great horror, declares the Lord. My people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and they have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns, that cannot hold water." So there's two things. They've forsaken God, the spring of living water, and they've dug their own cisterns. Now, we may be forgiven at this point for thinking, what has God got against plumbing? Cisterns, if we're not sure, were those kind of, underground kind of water tanks. You'd dig them into the ground and have some kind of plaster, limestone or something, to seal them. And the rainwater and the runoff water from rivers would drain into them, and that would be your kind of water supply. But these are broken cisterns. Let me rename the two sins for us, bring them up to date perhaps for us today. The two things that God identifies. One, they have turned off the God tap. And two, they've replaced it with a leaky pond. I think that is what Jeremiah is getting at. First, they've turned off the God tap. We live today in a part of the world and an era when we take water coming out of the tap for granted, don't we? Get hot day, go for a walk, get a bit sweaty, get a bit thirsty, come home, you can drink as much water out of your tap as you like. It's an absolutely glorious thing. Thanks to those at Wessex Water, Matt Wilden. I saw Matt really nodding, and I thought, why is he nodding so much at that? Ah, yes. Yeah. Thanks to the incredible scientists and the water that we drink is literally the water of life, isn't it? If that tap was turned off and you couldn't get it, you would die in a matter of days. You would be in serious trouble without that water from your tap. We have it flowing generously and coolly through our taps. It's wonderful. Now, most people in history, you don't need me to tell you, have not had that luxury. And indeed, many around the world today do not have that luxury. I remember spending some time in Niger, in Africa, and there was a severe drought. The temperatures were up at about 45 degrees. It hadn't rained for months. We, in our compound that we were living in, were fairly fortunate. We had plumbing, we had taps, but we would turn the tap, and often you would just get a kind of orangey dribble coming out, kind of Saharan sand colored dribble, and you'd have to filter it and all the rest, and it would taste weird and warm and not very pleasant, but we were the lucky ones. I've got a photo in my gap year album, which I will show you at some point. That's a threat. And this picture was the road that we were living on, and on it were just, as far as the eye could see, buckets, containers, water bottles, as people placed their containers in a queue so they could queue up and receive, for their family, their week's water ration. And they would go off with this, and that was what they had to drink, to clean, to wash, etc. Now, think of those people in Niger, in that situation, and come back to Jeremiah 2, verse 13 with me, where God says, "My people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water." So what he's saying is it's like someone in Niger, in that situation, with access to a river or a tap which works, deciding instead to join the queue of buckets and containers and queue up for a little portion of water. Spiritually, this people of God in Israel had turned off the God tap. They had forsaken him. They had turned their backs on him. They'd turned off the God tap. Now, at the risk of stating the bleeding obvious, this is spiritual disaster. In fact, this will lead inevitably to spiritual death. Turn off the spring of living water and you're not going to live very long. And yet, look at how the people in Jeremiah's day see it. Verse 31, which we had read, says this: "Why do my people say, 'We are free to roam, we will come to you no more'?" Do you see how they view the turning off of the God tap? They kind of say, they've turned off the tap and they say, "Hey, we're free to roam, we can go wherever we like. We can worship this person. We can do that. We can do whatever we like. They think they've chosen the freedom of not drinking from this tap of living water. Do you see the perversity of it? They're kind of, ha, we don't have to drink that water. We can do whatever we want. It's like the child. I don't know if your children have ever done this, those of you with children. The child who's angry with their family. And they say in triumph, I'm running away. And they leave the warm comfort and protection of the family home. They open the door to the cold wind and rain. They stand there with their flimsy sleeping bag under their arm. And they stomp defiantly down the garden. Until 10 minutes later, they kind of realize that their freedom was not quite as appealing as they'd realized. And they kind of sheepishly come back in. That's what the people of God were doing. You see, when we exchange serving God for freedom, as his people back then thought, and doing what we want, we actually swap the service of God for the service of something else entirely. Because human beings are worshippers. Whether we believe in God or nothing at all, we are all worshippers. We worship something. And so look, therefore, as we think about that, what the second big thing that these people get wrong is. So they've turned off the God tap, and then secondly, they replace the God tap with a skanky pond. Verse 13, they have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns, that cannot hold water. Now, during lockdown, I dug a pond. It was a sensible thing to do. I was inspired by one of my favorite programs, which I'm sure I share with many of you, which is Countryfile. And in Countryfile, they said that you should put water in your garden if you want wildlife to come. So I was inspired. I had the time. It was lockdown. I dug a pond in my garden. It had different levels for the different wildlife I was hoping to attract. It had little things for the froggies to climb in and out for. I bought some Cornish stone beautifully around the outside. It was lovely to stop our tortoise drowning. I even bought a pond liner, £20 off the internet. How was it 2 months later? I will tell you how it was. It was half empty. It was full of green algae, and it was smelling pretty fruity. Now, what had happened was that my brother's dog had played in it on a hot day. They were there for lunch outside. And I, being English, had pretended that I did not mind that my brother's dog was in our pond. But what had happened, clearly, was the dog had ripped a hole in my carefully laid pond liner and the underlay, which also went underneath the pond liner. And therefore, over the next couple of months, the water had slowly drained out until it was kind of just half empty and full of algae and nastiness. Now, imagine that that pond were my only source of water for life. I have defiantly turned my back on the hose pipe and tap option, and instead, I drink, wash, cook, clean with the water in my scummy little pond. That is essentially, spiritually, what the people of God were doing. But think about this, just because you turn off the God tap, it does not mean you no longer experience thirst. You just try to satisfy your thirst with different things. You dig your own cisterns, your scummy ponds, hoping that they will satisfy. That is what the people did 2,500 years ago, of course. We, however, in our day, we are far more sophisticated, a little bit different. No such problems here. Maybe not. Let me read to you the words of a novelist who sadly died in 2008, a chap called David Foster Wallace. He's not a Christian, a writer, but listen to these words. I think he absolutely nails this. So what he says, in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is no such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual thing to worship is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money or things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. Worship power, you will end up feeling weak and afraid. You will need ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. worship your intellect, being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. So as I read those words, I think, well, maybe we're not so different to those guys 2,500 years ago. Because that is exactly what they experienced in their chasing after other gods. Look at verse 36 and 37 in our reading, chapter 2. God says, why do you go about so much changing your ways? You will be disappointed by Egypt, as you were by Assyria. You will also leave that place with your hands on your head, for the Lord has rejected those you trust. Then he says, you will not be helped by them. You see the exasperation? They're not going to help you. Or verse 28, which we didn't have read a bit earlier in the chapter. Where then are the gods you made for yourselves? Let them come if they can save you when you're in trouble. God is saying it ain't going to happen. You are not going to be saved by those gods. In our day, money will not help you. Beauty will fade. When we do that, it's like licking around the bottom of a pond, thinking that's going to satisfy you. And Jeremiah puts it another way in verse 33 of our reading. He says, how skilled you are at pursuing love. Because he kind of gets that when we forsake the God of love, we end up pursuing love in all the wrong places. Do you recognize that in our day? We're maybe honest with ourselves, whether we're Christians or not. We're really honest. Perhaps we recognize some of that in our own lives and our own hearts as well. We have smartphones with endless social media feeds as we search for connection and meaning, and yet loneliness and mental health difficulties are the worst they've ever been. We have sexual liberation. Nothing is taboo in our society. And yet society fractures and families are torn apart. We have comfort like we have never known. We've got material things coming out of our ears, haven't we? See at Christmas, if I'm not wrong. And yet the poor remain and the rich are unsatisfied. So as a society, we have turned off the God tap. We've sought the same satisfaction in drinking from self-dug cisterns, skanky little ponds, which don't even hold water, let alone give life-giving, flowing, fresh water. So-called gods made from created things. As we reflect on that, it may be helpful for us to think, are we, as the church, any different from our society? And the result of those things, those sins as God calls them, is huge. Spiritual death, literally cutting ourselves off from the source of all life, but also a world ruined. See, when we get rid of God from our lives, then nothing is unthinkable. Probably behind this chapter in Jeremiah 2 is probably the reign of King Manasseh, who we're told in 2 Kings 21, filled Jerusalem with blood, even the blood of children as he partook in child sacrifice. And we're horrified by that, and yet we can look around the world today and see practices which may not be in effect too different. So this is a bleak picture of life in Jeremiah's day 2,500 years ago, isn't it? Pretty bleak, and yet I think it still rings true today. The dark velvet box is real. Now, let me give you a glimpse of the diamond. Let me show you the diamond. This is not a real diamond. These are earrings. Do you remember the famous bit in Isaiah, which is often wheeled out at carol services? Almost certainly you'll know this. Isaiah chapter 9, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. Why do we read that at Christmas? Well, because Christmas reminds us that darkness, even the darkness of our own making, our own sin, will not have the last laugh. The gospel writer John, or the fourth gospel, again, that first chapter of John is wheeled out, usually by the most important person in church or in the community. Don't know why we do that, that's weird. They read the prologue of John's gospel. Last reading of the carol service often, isn't it? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And it was the Word became flesh. And John, talking about this Word becoming flesh, says this of that person, Jesus. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. You see, the darkness is real, And we haven't, of course, even mentioned the darkness which is not our fault, the stuff which happens to us, the death, the disease, the disaster. But there is a diamond. In fact, there is something even better. There is a light which defeats that darkness by definition. And listen to what that light, the Lord Jesus, said to a woman who had sought satisfaction in all the wrong places. You probably know the story from John 4, the Samaritan woman. This is what Jesus says to her. Whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life. Interesting, isn't it? I think he had Jeremiah in mind. Do you see why this is a diamond set against a very dark, velvety box? Because the spiritual reality is that humanity turns off the God tap and suffers the consequences. But Jesus, we remember at Christmas, not only brings us back to the living water, he not only kind of reconnects us to the tap, if you like. He then says, we can have that very living water in us, welling up to eternal life. God himself plumbed into our souls. So if you are a Christian believer, that is what you have in you this morning. The Spirit of God, the living water welling up within you. So be encouraged amidst the darkness. If you are not yet a believer, hear this, which a friend of mine recently tweeted. It's a riff on O Come All Ye Faithful, which we sing at this time of year. I like this. O come all ye faithless, joyless and defeated. Christmas is for the weary, for the messed up and for the broken. If your life isn't Instagrammable, Christmas is for you. Now it may be that whether you'd call yourself a Christian or not, you feel overwhelmed by the darkness of your own sin, but also the darkness of the world around us. And it may be that we feel overwhelmed. If so, be encouraged by these words. I love this. A couple of verses of this poem. I'm going to pretty much close with these verses of this poem. Sums up what I've just been trying to say less well. Here we go. It's dark in the Bible when Christmas is spoken. Always a bolt from the blue for the broken. It's the valley of shadow, the land of the dead. It's no place in the inn, so he stoops to the shed. He's born to the shameful, bends to the weak, becomes the lowly, the God who can't speak. And yet, what a word, this Saviour who comes. Our dismal, abysmal depths he plumbs, through crib and then cross to compass our life, to carry and conquer our brother in strife. He became what we are, our failures he shouldered, to bring us to his life, forever enfolded. He took on our frailty, he took on all comers, to turn all our winters to glorious summers. It's Christmas now, whatever the weather. Some soak in the sun, some huddle together. But fair days or foul, our plight he embraces. Real Christmas can shine in the darkest of places. So as we finish, here are two questions for you to consider, at least one of which I've nicked from Joe's excellent Advent book. Firstly, what or where are your leaky ponds? The things you are tempted to worship and seek satisfaction in. Why not this morning bring those to God? Confess them before him. And secondly, following on from that question, how can you drink deeply from God to satisfy your spiritual thirst in the right places? We're going to have a time to pray into that now.